Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. Our programming is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com, and we're also brought to you by GetAzoff.com. Dr. Scott, we talked about this beforehand. We were going to talk a little bit about how should we even put this? Like, I guess intense training techniques.
Old school, like lost training concepts, actually, to some degree.
I like the sound of that. Yeah. I rediscovered Mike Mentzer. I knew who he was. I was familiar with his physique. I was familiar with, you know, some of his, like, the politics around him in competitive bodybuilding. I obviously knew what heavy duty was, but I had never really followed him closely. And Scott, I started watching his videos, which the amazing soundtracks, first of all. But his videos, early 80s.
You're going to rip those for your training, aren't you?
I am. Actually, we can use that for our intro music for this episode.
Hell yeah.
That stuff, man, there's a lot of aspects of it that's very similar to stuff that I'm currently doing, like the stuff that's making the most sense to me. And what I'm currently doing has kind of been like a bastardization of adopting things I've learned listening to you.
You call me a bastard? Is that what I got from that? All I got, you'd call me a bastard in the gym. Like, Scott made me do this shit, but it works. So, fucking bastard. So the thing you gotta think about with heavy duty training and Mike Mentzer is he had an evolution. So he was with the founder of Nautilus. What's his name? I'm blanking
Arthur
on
Jones.
His name. Right? Arthur Jones. Yeah. So
I've gone deep, Scott. Gone deep.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we're going back in time. So that was sort of some of the connection there, and the idea. It's been compared to DC training in the past.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, and the relevance of the comparisons are kind of a function of which version of Mike Mentzer, because he went a little bit overboard near the end. I don't know if you saw that when you're digging into him.
Not yet.
At all.
Not yet.
Like he got, it's been so long since I went and looked this up, but, and there are still acolytes, people who follow his ways and who do this, I think, like taking this, but he got to the idea that, you know, you want to have the most intense stimulus possible and make sure you absolutely, utterly maximize your recovery. So it was like, it got to be like one set a month or something like
wow.
that.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. It was literally at one point in time. And I think some of that was near the end of his days where I heard, you know, there was just rumors that he wasn't all that well physically or mentally. So he may have been trying to like figure out kind of a hook, you know, kind of a spiel
for
people. Like, and that's a great thing. So yeah, you go in the gym, you train three times a month and you get bigger than ever. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the thing about that, which I think happened to a lot of people, is you take someone who had been frustrated because they're trying to like literally do what Arnold did, follow Arnold's magazine routines.
Yeah.
It's way too much. And they tend to train too hard. And all of a sudden they deload and they get a rebound while they're doing heavy duty training or HIT or whichever version. And they grow like weeds.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that's awesome. So that this is the way to go. But it really wasn't so much, it was just the fact that they stopped overreaching or literally overtraining but went to a better system. So the thing that that's interesting about all like his, he didn't, this is what was also very enticing to people. So he was a big proponent of sort of the notions of Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.
Okay.
Yeah. Atlas Shrugged. You can Google all this stuff. And so he was like, he didn't read any of the Western scientific literature, as far as I know. Maybe he did, and he just didn't talk about it and won't admit it, but he never references anything about, you know, like Brad, this was long before, after he passed, like, you know, Brad Schoenfeld's article about what are the, you know, stimuli for muscle hypertrophy, and he didn't really talk about it from that. He just talked about it from the logical perspective that he derived in the trenches.
Yes. Yeah, I can see that.
And it was always like he'd write these articles for like Muscular Development or Flex Magazine, I think. Like I've, you know, read him in the old school magazines, and he's just waxing poetic, you know, all about like this is the way that would make the most sense, and talking about how people sort of they're no longer thinking in a logical way when they do this thing, blah, blah, blah. And it was all just sort of a logical perspective on this is the way to grow.
Okay.
And what kind of scene with his clients.
Hmm.
So, but it was very well, it was very sort of esoteric and, you know, a lot of long convoluted sentences along the ways that many philosophers will write. So it was attractive to someone of an intellectual density. You know, it's like, I kind of like this. Like what he's sort of saying makes sense. It's a thinking man's type of perspective on it all.
Yeah.
So, and it works for lots of people.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
As long as you don't like it, what he was talking about at the end, like it's not going to work, but, and it's like you take the people who's really who are really really motivated, and they turn that motivation in the gym,
mm-hmm.
and train really really hard,
mm-hmm.
and that matches with progressive overload, DC training, fortitude training, numerous other systems that are based on that basic principle.
That makes
where
sense.
Where you train as hard as you can, you like harness that essential quality of resistance exercise.
Yeah,
that is that it's so effortful and there's so much tension. That it's extraordinary and your body adapts.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that's kind of like, that's the HIT thing, but there are the people who still follow it. They're like, they just, it's a tribal type of thing. Really.
Interesting. I could see that. Degree.
A lot of them are like, they really are, there's not nearly as many. They're not as vocal as they used to be, but it was like, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. This is the way everyone should train. You know, like there's only one way, that sort of thing.
I'll tell you what. I mean, I could kind of say there was a time when people who followed DC might have been that way too.
Yeah.
You know, that's not unlike DC then in that way.
Well, yeah, it was. Some people would go overboard that way.
Okay.
In a way. And if you know, if you follow Dante, especially at the end, like part of why he got so burnt out was. He was constantly having that sort of felt like he was defending himself. People would like call him, and he'd get into these long online arguments about various things.
That'll burn anybody out.
Yeah, of course. And he took it like just his personality was like, you're not going to poke me and have me not poke you back.
Mm, yeah.
There was a guy, and this came up in a podcast I did a couple of days ago. His name was Scott something. I can't remember his last name. And he was like, he knew everything that Dante had written, basically.
Okay.
And it wasn't like a giant guy or anything like that. He just was a believer in the principles. And he used to go, he would basically, anywhere that someone had said something about DC training on the T-Nation boards, there's an article, there's actually an interview with him over there. And any other discussion board, he would take the information that Dante had written, or he would explain things for people.
Okay.
He kind of took the, you know, took the fire, the torch was sort of passed on to him. And Dante was totally cool with it. He was dead on with everything.
That's cool. Yeah.
And then he sort of vanished. Yeah, I don't know what happened to him. His name was Scott, and I can't remember his last name. But
so he's not doing it anymore. I was going to say, if he was still doing it, we could find him just by making a post somewhere and asking a DC, saying something stupid about DC, and he'd show up. Yeah. But apparently that's not going to happen anymore.
Yeah, we could bait him out, right?
Yeah.
You know? His last initial was an M, too, because they call him SM
on
the T Nation. No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. That's the thing. Obviously, it wasn't you. Maybe it was.
I won't tell you. I won't. Yeah. I'm not going to disclose either way. I'll tell you what. There was some. So here's what I saw.
Yeah, tell me more about you. What you saw?
Okay, this is what blew my mind. First of all, so having worked out with Shelby, which we've talked about a bunch of times, because that was a very formative experience for me. Shelby Starnes, and a lot of his training was, you know, John Meadows' stuff at the time. It evolved, and we did some Jordan Peters stuff toward the end, but. One of the things we really did was focus on like the structure of a rep even. And it would be like a 3-second negative. And when I say 3 seconds, I mean, you really count to four, because it's only when you get to the fourth second, 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000. And then when you hit four, that's the end of the rep. That's the end
or
of the third
zero,
second.
0-1-2-3. And that's a count of
there
four.
You go. There you go. Yeah. So doing negatives like that was something I had never done before. And I found, especially like my hamstrings really sucked for a long time, and doing 100 pump sets didn't change that at all. But over a period of 2 years of really doing slow negatives with them. And now I'm seeing Scott, slow negatives are for me are a big answer for growth across the board. Like that's been a big thing for me in this last 6 months to a year. That's a big aspect of what
but
I saw.
You haven't gained any weight, have you, Scott?
Actually, I have.
Yes. How much have you gained, by the way?
Okay. So as of, and we talked about this on the other shows, but I misquoted myself, or I said 25 pounds. It's actually 35 pounds from a year ago this time. Granted, I was dieting a year ago this time, and I was at my lowest weight that I'd been to in a long time, but I haven't been at 222-ish. I haven't been this heavy since about 2014. So I feel good. Maybe even 2013.
And your leanest 222, your leanest, absolutely, most muscle mass ever.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, yeah, and I'm not pushing the food like crazy either, which last time I was at that weight, I was eating a lot of food. I was using injectable D-ball plus, you know, DECA and everything else.
15 pounds of water.
Exactly. And I was huffing. You know, I was trying to, like, right, just, I was passing out every time I tried to lean to put my seatbelt on, tie my shoes. Now I'm comfortable. And man, I'm the strongest I've ever been too. And it's like good quality strength. I'm not afraid of using, you know, it's not like, oh shit, I might tear something on this. I'm being real careful and cautious, really wielding control over the weight. But so I'm employing a lot of this stuff that it's kind of just come together for me listening to, you know, having been taught by Shelby and listening to those things from John, having listened to John for years before that, John Meadows, following his stuff online forever. And then meeting you and listening to the way you've talked about training, and that my evolution has been down to, like, you know, just a couple of sets. And another thing is he would, the workouts I've seen, like chest, he would warm up with like a pec deck. That would be like the first exercise. He would then superset that with an incline press. I'm not supersetting, but I am definitely doing that to pre-exhaust, because I early on found pre-exhausting works well for me. So that's something Mentzer does. So looking at these sets, it's creepy to me, because I'm putting these things together where I, you know, do my warm up as much as I need to, then get to like just some really difficult pec deck, and then some really difficult incline press, and then I'm done, and that's it. And then I'm trying to use these really slow negatives and stuff. And it's just like, man, all this stuff is lining up. I've known a Mike Mentzer, I've known what heavy duty was, and I've known people who've listened to him and seen them train, but I didn't realize like how many similarities there was to his programming now.
And I'm glad you dug into that, because this is the course of human history. We keep on forgetting the lessons we once learned. That's why we keep on having wars. We keep on, like, you think you have a war and like everyone almost gets, you know, exterminated in the two countries or multiple countries involved. Like World War One was just horrible. Then we have World War. We keep on fighting wars because we keep on seem to forget that.
Yeah.
And history repeats itself. I told this story. I don't think he was here. I was telling this to someone. There's a guy named David Bruce Dill, who was kind of a legend in the world of exercise physiology. He was at the Harvard Fatigue Lab.
Okay.
And he was one of the subjects when they first were doing like VO2 max measurements. They have those measurements from when he was like 19 until like in his 90s.
Wow.
And he would go to like the American, like I remember hearing these stories. He would go to the American College of Sports Medicine annual convention and go to the expo hall where they have like all the poster presentations that the students would do.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of people didn't know who he was, because he's, you know, retired like 15, 20 years before that, but he's like the man. He's done so much stuff. And he would just literally go from poster to poster and say, "Why are you doing that? Like, don't you read the literature? We did that in 53.
Yeah, yeah.
All these pre-medline studies. Because people just keep doing the same thing. They just repeat it. And those things that Mike Mentzer was doing, to some degree, people, like, they don't know that was done before. So, like, someone else comes out with, you know, whatever, super high force training, and they it's just basically just Mentzer reinvented. I saw a thing. Someone tagged me on Instagram. She was doing a muscle round.
Okay.
And actually she wasn't quite doing it the way I would have suggested. She wasn't resting. She was doing a dumbbell curls, and she wasn't putting them down during the rest periods.
Okay.
So I helped her out with that. And someone else said, "Oh, I'm doing something like this." And he's talking about cluster sets. He's like, "It's called DC training. I'm not quite sure how many sets to do. It must be new. We'll see how it goes." And I'm I'm like, "I don't think it's going to go very well, because you don't even know how many sets to do, because he hasn't," like, right? He hasn't gone to intense muscle.
Yeah.
Which has, you know, the largest, like, that's the original stuff that DC wrote. It's not an article that someone else put together on another board.
Yeah.
But he thinks it's brand new. It's like, no, this isn't new.
Well, new to you, maybe. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but like, and he's got 14, and this guy had like 14,500 followers on Instagram.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. So it wasn't like he was just sort of an anonymous guy who popped in. Like he's, you know, he's a fitness model, something like that. Yeah. And so it was just interesting like that. That will continue to happen again and again and again and again. And some people take advantage of that because they want to sell a novel approach.
Yeah,
to people.
I could see that. Sure.
But a lot of times it's just like you need to acknowledge those things. That's why like Dante would acknowledge John Perillo when it came to extreme stretches.
Yeah.
And I acknowledge Dante in calling one of the stretch versions in my program an extreme stretch. I called the same thing.
Yeah.
Rest pause is a Mike Mentzer technique.
Okay.
That's the terminology that he used.
He's the first one to invent that term.
He's the one who, as far as I know, he's the one who came up with that term. And It was like, literally, I think you were doing like singles, like for six with like 20 or 30 seconds in between with like 95% of one rep max or something like that. It was very different than a DC training rest pause set.
Okay.
And this is before the term cluster set even kind of came about, I believe.
Okay.
But Dante, he saw that and he saw something usable with that, just like I found Muscle Rounds by Leo Costa and found something usable from that. And I held onto the term.
Yeah.
So because I wasn't trying to steal his intellectual property. I'm like, this is my version of a muscle round.
Yeah.
This is Dante's version of a rest pause set.
Yeah.
He acknowledged Perillo. I acknowledged Perillo and Dante. You know, so if people who don't do that, they're like,
they're trying to say,
may not even know. They may not even know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like Mentzer, and people used to always say, oh, DC training is just HIT, you know?
Yeah, no, I can see it. I mean, I knew DC enough to see the differences. Now when I'm looking at like hit, like high intensity, that's different. Heavy duty.
Yeah,
it's different.
It is, but it's got that same progressive overload based. And if you don't see the nuances, if you haven't done both and dug into both, you would just lump them together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I will say like watching the video, it was the video you had mentioned before we recorded where he was in the gym with, what was the guy's name? Michael,
Marcus Reinhardt.
Yeah, Marcus.
Great German name, but he may obviously have German heritage, but he's an American.
Yeah, so they did. I need to do a lot more warm ups than what he, and maybe that has to do with age. But what they showed in the video, he was on a, they were the warm ups they did were not enough for me. That's for sure. I need a lot more than that. It was like four sets. You know, one very light, then one.
Right.
Decently moderate, then one pretty heavy, and then just a couple of reps of something that was fairly very heavy, and then you're ready.
How many would you need to do, like six something?
Maybe it, like, it depends. I found that the heavier I go, if I'm gonna do to make sure that everything's good, and I'll do a lot of feeder sets. So if, you know, we've talked about before, like if I'm at like the 110 pound dumbbells on my incline presses, I'll start with the 50s and I'll do 8 to 10. Then I'll go to the 60s and I'll do 5. And I'll go to the 70s and I'll do 3. And I'll go to the 80s and I'll do 2 or 3. And go to the 90s. Yeah. And do, so I guess that's like 6. And then, and then I'll get right up there. Even if I don't feel 100%, it's sometimes too, it's like that CNS thing that like my body's not ready to handle the weight. And I might need to pick up, if I'm doing 110s, I might need to pick up the hundreds and just do 1 or just do 2. And then I'm ready, you know, but it does take me a lot, I found, to be ready to be like that 100% ready to kill it, you know.
I think it's psychological in your head.
Okay.
Because you got a pattern, like, you know, some people, they always have to have the plates facing in, you know.
Yes.
And the plates always need to be like, you know, if the plates interlock in some way, they have to be interlocked, you know. We can't have anything, so like that has to be in place.
Okay.
We're ritualistic. Maybe OCD a little bit too, you know.
No. Times. Us bodybuilders?
No, a chance. And then there's the neurological. Like literally it's a skill. And like, I know you've probably done this. It happens with squats a good bit. Some of this could be related to potentiation technique possibility in the muscle. But if you go and like warm your way up to like a heavy set of like 6 to 8, and then you drop back down to, you know, a set you're going to get for 10 to 12. If you did those in reverse order, even though you're fatigued when you do the lighter set later, it just feels lighter.
Yes, it does.
After you've done the heavier set. Yeah.
Yeah.
Powerlifters do that all the time. They do that. Like, that's a typical, like, guys will just go, just when they're on a day they're going to squat, or maybe as part of their training in some way, shape, or form, they'll, like, let's say they're an 800-pound squatter, they'll just load 1,000 pounds on the bar,
okay,
and just unrack that shit and hold it.
Just feel it, huh?
Yeah, it's like, just like, they're not going to try to squat it because they get crushed. Huh. But like, if you can unrack 1,000 and hold it there,
whew,
you know, and then put it back, well, then the 800 feels light.
I get that. Yeah, I totally. That's a big part of it.
Yeah, it's neurological and psychological, because then the flip side of that is, like, you go to that heavyweight and you just start the first rep, or you're getting ready and you're like, oh shit, this shit's gonna crush me.
Yeah,
it's the wrong mentality.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you're fucked. And there's just the muscular aspect of it. You want to warm the muscle up, you know, for tendons tend to be a little more elastic at higher temperatures, so it helps with the elasticity. It's probably an injury prevention thing there,
okay,
potentially, et cetera, okay, et cetera.
And then I'll back it down at that one heavy set, and then I'll try to back it down by 10-15 pounds or percent, you know, and then try to get as many as I can, you know, 10, 12, 15, whatever. Try to get as many as possible.
What did Mentzer do? Like, he just had him do like a supersetted pec deck and like an incline press or something like that, I think.
Yep. And you would do them, superset together. You just go from one straight into the other.
Yeah.
And that's where one of the things that differs, that the warm up differs, and then the way he's supersetting them differs from what I'm doing. But I also see those like very similar lines, you know. Mm-hmm. It's made a lot of sense to me. How important was, like, was there ever a time that you, because I know with DC, you know, that's been something that you were a big part of, and it was a big part of your life and your training. Was there a time that you ever followed, like, the high intensity, heavy duty program?
Well, like I said, that video with Marcus Reinhardt, a friend of mine gave that to me. She's like, I figured you'd just like this, you know?
Yeah.
No, I never explicitly followed that. I literally, the only programs I can think of that I've explicitly followed, I've taken, begged and borrowed things.
Yeah.
And then I was doing a lot of the things. I wasn't doing the cluster test, but I was doing basically the same training frequency and about the same volume as DC training when I came across DC training. And then I said, well, I'm going to just do this, because it was just like, it wasn't much of a modification really. And then I followed it, of course, because Dave and I started doing that. And I suggested Dave get coached by Dante, which he did. And then I did the Titan training.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever is best. Who knows? I probably didn't do it properly, but I learned a lot from that. But I'm trying to think. No, I never really, I couldn't even tell you, because what Mentzer put forth changed over the years. So, like, you know, like Dante, I think, still sticks with like the basic two-way split, training 3 times a week. Like, that's like a good starting spot for someone who's like intermediate.
Okay.
You know, who doesn't know they haven't pushed things in various ways. That's a great place to begin if you're really lacking in size. But Mentzer, like, you like listen to stuff he said near the end, the once a month type shit, versus, you know, what he was probably doing in that video.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if he had like a basic routine that people follow. Like, that's what Marcus did.
Oh, okay.
And I watched that video. It's been so long. I have it on VHS, so that tells you how old it is.
Yeah.
They didn't even have DVDs then. And I don't think. Or he didn't even have it out in a DVD. And I think he refers to the fact that the program that they demonstrate, but basically the way in which they demonstrate HIT is a function of Marcus's advanced status. So he was a national level guy at the time.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, good bodybuilder. He wasn't, he never became a pro. But he was like, you know, could have probably won a state show wherever he was. He was competed at the USAs, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing that I want to reiterate here, because it's something I thought about after doing another podcast, and then I talked about on the Brains and Gains podcast with Dave McConey. It'll probably come out in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
It was going to have 3 parts probably, because we talked 3 hours. And it applies to HIT. So, on this podcast, the idea was, you know, generally volume versus intensity of effort.
Okay.
So HIT at one end of the spectrum, DC at that end of the spectrum, that side of the spectrum, then like Renaissance periodization, some of the things that Mike Israetel has put forth, the people who really are volume advocates and leaving a lot of reps in the tank.
Okay.
So, you know, better to even start off leaving like, you know, 3 or 4 reps in the tank at the beginning of a training blast when you're more likely to get sore, so you're more sensitive to the stimulus. And I agree with that.
I could see that, yeah.
Yeah, like if people come back with fortitude training, if they've done a cruise and they come back into blast,
yeah,
you know, don't, if you know that you tend to get sore, don't start off with like the high volume to just destroy yourself.
Right, yeah.
You don't need it, you know. There's no reason for that. Get the most from the least. And the thing that I think happens as people get more advanced, there's two things that are going on. And this is why HIT makes sense, or at least moving in that direction makes sense, I think, for many people, is you learn to train harder. Over the course of decades, you're also getting older.
Yeah.
But what the inroads, to use sort of Mensarian, and that's a Menser term, I think, I like it. I don't like the term fatigue. People talk about, you know, the fatigue that's incurred by a training blast or a training cycle.
Okay.
Because if you look in the exercise physiology literature, fatigue is used in a totally different way.
Mm.
People don't talk about fatigue in that way at all.
Okay.
Fatigue is like the percent decline in force over the course of an exercise test, how long you can run at a given intensity or something like that.
That makes sense.
How many reps you can do with 50% of a 1 rep max. It's an acute measurement, not a chronic indicator. Training status. So anyway, so you get more advanced and you're able to train harder. And now as you're, I'm going to go do it this way. So there's a law of diminishing returns. So, you know, when you're a newbie, you can do anything and you gain some muscle mass. Most people will, if you're a non-responder. And then, you know, 5-10 years into it, or even just a few years into it, you're getting close to as much muscle you're going to gain.
Hmm. Yeah.
So people will talk about effective reps. I'm sort of tying together some principles. So when you're starting off as a newbie, let's say you're picking a 15 rep max, you might get a set. If you took that set all the way to the 15th rep, those last 3 or 4 reps might have been effective ones. People say 5 is the number that that Chris Beardsley has come up with people sort of toss that as a blanket statement, the last 5 reps of a set. But that's not true if you're doing if you pick a weight you can do 6 times, you just do a single with it or a double. Well, probably didn't get anything from that second rep. Yeah. You could do it 6 times. It's not nearly hard enough. But there's something to say for that. But over time, if you look at your 15 rep max, it might go from 225 to 405. So when you're a newbie, those last 4 or 5 reps are all effective. But as you get more and more advanced, looking just at your 15 rep max, you can't stop those sets 5 reps short or 4 reps short of failure and expect to get a stimulus that's going to bring you closer to what your ultimate potential for muscle mass would be.
That makes sense.
You have to take those sets further. You have to move closer and closer to failure.
Huh. Yeah.
And Dave brought this up in the context of asking Brad Schoenfeld, who's done some of this literature, done some of this work. I think he's an author on there's a meta-analysis looking at failure versus non-failure training. It suggests that failure training doesn't have any advantage over non-failure training.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter, but most of those are with beginners.
Mm.
And John Meadows talks about, like, you have those challenge sets, you got to push yourself.
Mm-hmm.
DC Dante talks about that. I've got failure points in my training system. Jordan obviously is big on failure. Menser is huge on failure and the quality of the set.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many voices who are talking about people like trying to eke out all you possibly can from your training, which means you're talking about advanced people who are getting close to that asymptote where like the muscle mass they have is very near what they can possibly ever get,
mm-hmm.
given the things they're doing with food and drugs and what have you. So the effective reps you get from any given set with a given load relative to your current strength levels becomes fewer and fewer. Now stopping at a 12 reps in a 15 rep max set, it might give you 1 effective rep, whereas that would give you 2 or 3 in the past. But when you're advanced, now you're using 405 as opposed to 225.
Mm.
So the volume that you can handle will tend to go down.
Mm, yeah.
This happened with Dorian Yates. You learn to train so friggin' hard, mm-hmm. hard, and that's, you have to, because you're using those weights, that you can no longer do like like, you know, I imagine doing like the Brad Schoenfeld study that people keep on bringing up, where they're doing like 45 sets a week.
Mm-hmm.
And they're supposedly all to failure.
Hmm.
Try that, Scott. Give that a shot.
There's no way.
Talk to us 2 weeks later. See how you're doing.
Scott, that last right? That last dumbbell incline press that I did, I normally, like I said, I do one set and then a back off set. I did the one set and I was done. Like, yeah. Normally I do a back off set, but there's no need. I could tell. I was like, God, right. There's, I want to leave the gym now. Like, I got to, yeah. I got to go home and just cry, because that's all I can handle.
Right. So there's two things happening. Then the number of sets that you can, because of how you're training, the load you're using and how hard you have to train, the number of sets that you have that you can recover from goes down.
Okay.
If you're training in this way, you just can't keep doing 20 sets.
Yeah.
But in order to get reps that are effective, you have to take those sets closer to failure, or if you're like,
oh, yeah,
Mike Mentzer, you're to failure, and you may even have to use quote-unquote intensification techniques, force reps, force negatives. Cluster sets are kind of a way to do that, in a way you're eking out more effective reps.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a rest pause set is in DC training.
Yeah,
it's, you're taking like maybe a 10 to 12 rep max, and you go to failure, so you get two or three effective reps. You take your breaths, you use the same weight, and you get three or four reps. Well, maybe not the first one, but the last two or three are effective reps.
Yeah.
So you spare yourself all those reps that really didn't do shit.
Yeah.
That way, because they're not really going to – they're too easy. It's only at the end when you have maximal recruitment of the muscle and you're creating the stimulus with the combination of fatigue and tension. So you're collecting in the course of a rest-pause set effective reps.
Hmm.
And so – now you look at this advanced person, in order to get an effective rep from a set, they have to go to failure.
Yeah.
And that means using heavier loads, and that means they can only do, and because they're training harder than what they did when they were a beginner or an intermediate, they can only recover from so many. So your volume goes down and you have to train harder.
Mm-hmm.
So this is sort of my explanation for whether or not failure is important, or training closer to failure, at least learning how to train harder the more advanced you got compared to when you were less trained.
Okay.
And that's really at the root and the heart of what Mentzer had been saying, like through most of his sane years during of high intensity training, is that the essential feature of this, of weight training, is what you get with those effective reps at the end of the set.
Hmm.
And that's what you want. Those are the ones that matter.
Hmm.
So do your sets to get all those effective reps and then get out of the gym and recover.
Hmm.
And if you really go, like, and I think there's, I mean, if you think about it, like some people would, they might really have a 15 reps in them.
Mm-hmm.
If you said, you know what, we're going to, you know, your family's here, they're going to be sacrificed if you don't get 15. Well, they would get 15. Normally they might get 13.
Yeah.
But the inroads to recovery and quote unquote the effectiveness of those last two reps,
mm-hmm,
when it's a do or die situation, those reps, all effective reps are not equal.
Hmm.
So it's not like you're doing the set, you know, and you get to the 11th rep and all of a sudden there's number 12, that's an effective rep. Boom, it's a unit, you know, and number 13, huh. 12 and 13 are different.
Huh. Yeah.
13,
okay.
Where you normally stop, that's where you would fail. Not necessarily maybe because the muscle couldn't produce more force, but psychologically, you're just not willing to go past that.
Yeah.
But then you do 14 and 15. Those are more effective, but there's a payoff. You go to failure, and something about, especially if it's truly failure, something about that will really whack you.
Mm.
And this is what I found, like, because you know this, if like you did that, like let's say you did that lighter set into true failure, and went back to try to do it, you could rest 5 minutes, right? Like the muscle should be, everything should be good to go.
Yeah.
You'd probably be 3 or 4 reps short of what you got the first time.
Hmm. Yeah,
even probably. Though the effort, is that about right? I mean, at least 2 reps probably shy.
At least, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up, guys? Scott McNally here, and we're gonna jump to a quick commercial break. So I promise that I'll be brief with this. So this week, we have 5 podcasts coming out. Between the new improved drugs and stuff, we have our Road to North Americans. Of course, Ron and Dusty are back. And then we have Dr. Scott Stevenson laying down some sick knowledge about HIIT training. And we have our new show, Renegade Muscle, with the one and only Lee Priest, along with Jeff Roberts. You know, I'm recording every single one of these programs. I do all the editing, the art, the MP3, the YouTube. And, you know, and it takes a lot of time. I'm not complaining because this is definitely a labor of love. I'm living my best life through this. But the only way I can make that work is by somehow getting paid in the process. And that's where our advertisers come in. So, guys, if you enjoy the shows, then I encourage you to shop with our advertisers, because I put these advertisers together with our programs because I believe in them, A, and B, because they're companies that make sense, you know, for us. TrueNutrition.com has some of the greatest supplements that are out there for some fantastic prices. I absolutely believe in them. And they basically carry everything that a bodybuilder could use, from health supplements to performance supplements and a lot more. They have basically every protein under the sun, every flavor that you could think of. They have it all for reasonable prices. So check them out, TrueNutrition.com, and you could use our code ADVICES. And then you could check out GetAzoth.com, where we also have a link to their Amazon. Both of those, you can use the code ADVICES10, and they have some of the best nootropics that are available out on the market. If you're looking to like up your edge in life, those things can definitely help. They're fun to experiment, and it's fun to see, you know, like basically just, well, I use them with my podcasting, and I definitely know that I've gotten an edge. So you can get an edge anywhere, be it in work or the gym or a long road trip, whatever it may be. But like I said, I've paired with the advertisers that I believe in, and advertisers that make sense to us. So if you enjoy our programming and that these are the types of products that you would buy anyway, then please consider shopping with our sponsors and using our codes, because that allows me to continue to put these podcasts out. All right, guys, thanks for listening to me. I appreciate it. We've got links in the show notes. Let's get back to the program.
Yeah. So
also too, I found that not only the my quality will be better, like if I'm using the heaviest weight I can, what I want to do on that back offset is like wield even more control, like hyper control that back offset, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Really wield as much control over that weight as I can with the negatives and making it count as much as I possibly can, which it's just impossible to do with like the absolute heaviest weight you can handle, you know?
Yeah. The research supports that. When I do this mind muscle connection lecture, you can look at EMG and you tell people, like on a bench press,
yeah,
don't use your triceps, use your pecs. And so you have a one rep max, you sort of establish the baseline EMG, and then you look at the ratio of the activation of those two muscle groups, the triceps versus pecs. And people can do that at 40, 50, 60%. Mm-hmm. You can effectively preferentially use the target muscle.
Yeah.
But when you get so heavy that you don't see the difference anymore. And of course you don't, because when it's your one rep max, you're using everything maximally.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no way to like you have to use triceps and pecs almost as much as possible when you're at 90% of one rep max.
Yeah.
So like 80% is like on a barbell press would be like 8 to 10 reps maybe.
Yeah.
That's about where the mind muscle connection can no longer at least be measurable in terms of EMG. You're getting a smile like someone just posted something.
No, I want to take a minute for everybody who's listening to the show right now just to point out that I made an observation about something that's like really profound to me in the gym, and automatically Scott has a study that he can cite and give me some serious, like concrete evidence to back up what I'm talking. I love that. That's what Muscle Minds is about right there, guys. There's that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because like people will fall into one of two camps, like they're the bros and we can figure all this all out in the gym, and you can.
Yeah.
And like, and also, you know, science can figure out a lot of this stuff. And there's, you know, post people say like the bro, you know, the science guys wearing their, you know, the pencil necks with their pocket protectors and their, you know, glasses with the tape in the middle and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Like they don't get in the gym and figure shit out. And that's to some degree, that's true. You don't see a lot of big jack guys that are also, you know, toiling away in the ivory tower doing their stuff. But it's all the same universe, as I say, like the universe that's being, you know, explored in the lab is the same universe that's being explored in the gym. Hmm. And that shit should overlap to some degree if you really understand the science.
Yeah.
And you really understand what's going on in the gym. So like those two things, it's like, yeah, it's not like the physics are different, you know, like, you know, stuff that's green here is red here. It doesn't happen that way, you know?
Yeah.
So there's always like, those are the connections I always look for, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a hard time with it sometimes with the study stuff, just because like when you tell me that, like, well, it doesn't matter if you go to failure or not. I'm like, but it does. And I'm like, I don't want to spend my life arguing about it. And especially because I can only tell you, like, I know that's not a fact, period. I'm not going to talk anymore.
Well, here's the thing. When someone just says that, and this is why Brad answered that question in that way, when Dave on the Brains and Games podcast asked him about it, he's like, because Brad was a trainer for decades. Okay. Like, he was in the gym. Yeah. He's not known as this monstrous guy, but he's competed before, I think. I think there's a picture of him on stage.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's why, how he came to all this. He's like, you know, there's all this shit. I want to, like, see if the science can back it up. And that's why he's done the very cool stuff he's done. Mm. And he has the sense that statement that failure doesn't matter is not an accurate one when it comes to advanced guys. Mm. And, you know, that my explanation, that what I was rambling about for those last, you know, 10 minutes about effective reps,
yeah,
is why I think that makes a difference. But if you look at those studies, very often the large majority of the studies are done with untrained people because they grow really well. And you need to see some muscle mass changes if you're going to look to see if something matters for muscle mass.
Yeah, yeah.
You take people in the gym and you train them for 12 weeks and nobody grows in either group. Like,
yeah.
Well, that doesn't really help. Like, you need to have the effect. You know, does it change hunger? Well, if hunger's not changing, like, you can't tell whether or not, like, something is working to change hunger or not, or
right,
whatever your dependent variable is. And with untrained people, like, they're getting so many effective reps. If you stop, you know, shy of failure, you've got, you know, someone might do, if they stop four shy of failure versus one shy, or take it to failure.
Yeah.
Or let's say two shy of failure versus failure, they're still getting three effective reps.
Mm, right, right.
And there's going to be so much variability. We talked about this before on the podcast. The study where the initial publication was frequency of training doesn't matter. They looked at 2 and 3 times and 5 times a week training.
That's right. Yeah.
Train the left leg, train the right leg, right?
Yeah.
It didn't matter, like, because they took the means and there's so much variability, like, the statistics didn't suggest any difference. But when they looked at the individual data points, mm-hmm, people were training one leg one way and the other leg the other way. Mm. That made a difference. Mm. Then it mattered for those individuals.
Yeah.
Some grew really well, some didn't grow really well. Some did better with higher frequency, some did better with lower frequency.
Yeah.
So you find, like, it makes sense. Like, if you look at the studies which have largely investigated whether failure or not matters in untrained individuals or previously untrained individuals, you find that you don't see generally speaking a difference. Doesn't matter. So you don't got to, like, destroy your it makes sense actually for adherence. If you're a trainer,
yeah,
and you want to make sure people kind of like the training, like, if you go in and, like, just try to destroy them and, like, you know, you're screaming with, you know, bloodshot eyes and veins popping out of your head,
yeah,
they can smell what you had for breakfast that day. You don't want that. That's not going to, like, keep people coming back. They can stop if you were, and they're going to get a lot of the gains that they're going to get. Probably, you know, if you get most of your gains in, like, the first 2 years of training, which a lot of people will, because they're just not going to push beyond that, then, you know, people aren't doing studies, failure versus non-failure, that last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you're probably going to get, you know, 80% versus 100%. And given how much muscle people gain, that's like, I don't know, let's say that's like 12 versus 15 pounds of muscle mass over 2 years.
Yeah, and not having the head gone crazy then, you know, in the process for 2 years, and your joints are probably going to be better off. And then I guess that makes sense to those people.
Yeah. But for people who are trying to do what you're trying to do, or me, or Jordan, or what Dante and Dante's clients, and what Marcus Reinhardt, et cetera, it can make a difference.
Yeah.
If you don't go really close to failure, you're not going to make any progress because you're not creating any effective reps. The stimulus is, there's no stimulus.
And I think everybody who's listening or watching this now has been there at some point where they've been working out and not making progress, because most people in the gym, like, I could really say most people, if you take some time away from the gym that you normally go to and you come back 6 months later, people look pretty much the same when you come back.
Oh yeah. That's something Dante said again and again. It's all, And it's just, a lot of people aren't willing to push beyond that. You know, they go to the gym to talk and that kind of stuff too.
So the question is like, you know, we all love working out, but it's like, are you going to be willing then to still do what it takes to grow? You know what I mean? Like, are you really going to be willing? Because you can. That's what I'm seeing now, I guess. I'm seeing is that you can. You still can, you know?
you got to push the food. Like the other big thing that people, and this has come up. Dave has who does the Brains and Gains. He's posted on Professional Muscle about this topic with Dante, and they're actually like, it's an active thread right now.
Okay.
And when someone's a beginner, you got the holy grail. You can literally you can gain muscle and lose fat at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's studies of like people, like they're just like gym classes, like back in the 50s and 60s. And they just have a group that would weight train. They have a group that would start a jogging program.
Okay.
And they just do like hydrostatic weighing, underwater weighing, and they get like the equivalent changes in muscle in fat-free mass.
Yeah.
Just from becoming more active.
I could see that.
They're just jogging. That's not a great way to put on muscle mass.
Yeah.
But you're so sensitive to the increased activity, your body will change that way. So you get someone who's trained for like 4 or 5 years, and they're like, I want to put more muscle on my arms. And I've tried supersets and drop sets, and you know, I'm doing all this crazy stuff. And it's like, well, okay, so you've been doing this for 2 years, your arms haven't grown, and you say, well, those things don't work. It's like, well, how much weight have you gained?
Yeah.
None, like nothing. I weighed 190 2 years ago. I weighed 191 right now. It's like, why would you expect your arms to grow?
Hmm.
You can't, like, you could do that initially, mm-hmm. but eventually you also need to have everything else in place to support the anabolic stimulus that you provided with the training.
That makes sense.
And that's like, that's the thing that you don't, it's kind of funny. Nowadays, they will, in many of the studies, like a lot of the ones that Stu Phillips does, I notice this if you read the methods.
Okay.
They will provide their subjects with a 20 gram bolus of protein.
Okay.
After the training. Like that's just a standard. They'll just do that because they know that increases the protein synthesis brought on by the training.
Okay.
It's just like smart. Like why would you, why would you administer a training variable or training workout and then not do the things to support that? You're doing that so you can create growth and then determine whether some condition impacts the growth or not, the frequency of training or some other supplement or what have you. So if they're giving no supplements, they'll just give the protein.
Okay.
And that's the thing, like with advanced trainees, it's very, unless the study is looking at nutrition specifically, they'll sometimes do a recall, which are notoriously inaccurate.
Okay. What's a recall? Yeah, what is it?
Like, a dietary recall. Like, tell us what you ate.
Oh, I see. Okay.
No. Yeah. And, you know, it's better than nothing.
Sure.
But, you know, but people will just, if they sort of think like, what is, you know, what am I supposed to be doing? They'll sort of like, they'll fudge sometimes unconsciously the things that they write down.
Mm, yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, I would have eaten that. So they just write it in.
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing. So, but you don't like take advanced, you know, and say, okay, well, here's what we know from, generally speaking, from the literature. We need to ensure that you have this much protein. We need to ensure that you have that you're actually gaining weight.
Mm-hmm.
A pound a week or something like that. And you could almost like, I would love to see like, it's, this would be like impossible to do because there's so much effort that goes into training studies.
Hmm.
But you could almost like literally say, you know, if we don't get you gaining like at least 1 pound
mm-hmm.
a week or a half a pound or something, the weight has to be going up, then we wouldn't expect you to get any muscle at all because you don't have the nutritional status to bring that about. So it's like, there's no point even like looking at your data.
Yeah. Okay.
We know we're not going to get anything out of you if you're advanced. Like so someone comes, like I've been training for 5 years, you know, and I've been trying to put weight on mass on my arms and I'm doing all these things. I'm like, well, what's your diet like? This is what Dante's actually saying now that I think about it in that thread.
Okay.
You know, it's like one guy, I can't remember who it was. I just read Dante's response. And one guy said he put on 40 pounds and like all of it was fat or something like that.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, Dante's like, hey, that's not training, dude. Like, that's your diet. Like,
yeah.
Something's wrong with your diet.
Yeah, like, I started lifting weights.
Genetics, but that's like extreme. Like, maybe your just genetics are that terrible.
Yeah.
That you just gain 40 pounds. Like, normal on average, people put on about 1/3 of the weight just in overfeeding studies from fat-free mass.
Huh.
That's what they generally show. But there's variability there.
It's definitely not the training. I'm just imagining, like, oh, I started going to the gym and I'm getting fatter every week. I don't know what's going on. I did more bench press and now I've got even fatter.
Getting fatter, yeah. But that's the thing. Like I always say, if you could just take that 1/3 of your weight gain from fat-free mass and turn it into 2/3.
Yeah.
So you put on 30 pounds, you get 20 pounds of muscle.
Hell yeah.
Pretty good.
I'll take it.
Not bad.
I without having increased anything else at first, I had kind of built my food up and I've kept it where it is. And now my latest, this is my latest change, Scott. I'm adding this in as of my next workout. Mountain Dogs Perry MD from our sponsor, True Nutrition. I love this stuff too, because you know what? It doesn't fill me up one scoop while I'm training. So I get 25 extra grams carbs, plus I get some essential amino acids. And I'm going to go back to doing a protein shake post-workout, just one scoop. That I haven't been doing that. That leaves my stomach, like gastric emptying happens fast for me with that. And I'm not like feeling like bloated and all like, you know, just bloated in full. Other carbs I've done, sometimes I'll feel bloated and full for a couple hours after I train, like maltodextrin. Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, for sure.
So,
you know, I was going to say the other thing too that's interesting, like this, I've mentioned this before.
Yes, I wanted to hear about this book.
Yeah, so what this is this? Professional Intensity Training Techniques, Carsten Feuchtenreuther.
The book, it keeps going like it's blurred out with your background. Sorry. Yeah. There you go.
Awesome cover.
Yeah. Yeah, the background blur was catching it. It looked like we were trying to blank it out.
Yeah, so. So this is only in German, so people aren't going to – they haven't translated to English. But you can find videos of people doing these sets.
What is this?
So there's actually a study I dug up not too long ago, and they compared like just regular straight sets with a kind of a rest-pause technique. And then they had another group that basically was doing this. And in the rest pause technique, I think they use like 80% of a one rep max. And they drop the weight down after a given number of, you know, it was basically very similar to a rest pause style cluster set from DC training. In this, what was basically very close to this, you basically do intermittent reps, Widowmaker style, until you just, but you're resting in between so you can put the weight down. Until you just can't lift it anymore.
Wow.
And in this study, they progressed them based on their performance during the training sessions. And they had them using 90% of a one rep max.
Okay.
And they were, which is normally about a three rep max, like the weight you can lift like three times.
Yeah.
And they would increase the weight when those people were able to do 18 reps in a set.
So it was a long time then.
Yeah, they would rest between – I was like trying to figure out what the hell they did, and they weren't like – it wasn't a standardized rest interval. They would let them rest up to 20 seconds, so between 5 and 20 seconds. So they pick up a near max load, like a triple weight they could probably do three times. There's no fourth rep because it's so heavy.
Yeah.
And they'd start doing reps and resting in between up to 20 seconds.
They would do as many reps as they could or just one rep?
They would manage their fatigue to get as many reps as long as they didn't rest more than 20 seconds in between.
Holy
that was
crap.
Their limit. So like imagine like, you know, you're like what could you do for a triple on dumbbell presses?
I've never tried, but if I'm at the 110s, let's just say 150.
150s. So imagine you have those set up with like you've got some daisy chains around them and you're in like a power rack so that like you have a starting spot and you can just let go and rest. So you got the 150s and they're dangling there. Mm-hmm. You got Power Hooks maybe, which is a great product. We talked about Power Hooks before. They fit around the dumbbell handle and they have hooks. You can put it on a bar up above your head so you have a starting spot.
Yeah.
But now you just got them dangling right here. So you take those 150s and you do a double. Okay. You don't go to failure because you're going to see you want to get as many reps as you can. And like your life depends on getting as many reps as long as you don't rest 20 seconds. So then you do a single and you just rest 5 to 20 seconds and do another single. Just rest. Maybe you rest 8 seconds this time. So you can get another
up
single
up to 20,
up to 18 was the number. Oh, the up criteria to 18. Number they used. Well, when people like that's just friggin' brutal.
Yeah, that is.
These are like, you can watch these videos of these people. Like these are like Widowmaker, like hyper Widowmakers. They're just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because you're just trying to get as many reps as you can. with that weight, and you rest in between. You just kind of keep going until like your will breaks every time. Like every set is like that. Like with the Widowmaker, the idea is like there's some limit on how many reps you're going to get because you don't let go of the weight. You still keep it on your back or you're holding it or whatever. So eventually fatigue will just prevent you from continuing. Well, on this one, you're resting in between, like you're managing your fatigue. So those had to be like, let's say the average 10 seconds, they did 18. So that's like 180 seconds just to rest. So that's like 3 minutes of rest.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Plus the reps. Those are like 4 minute sets.
Yeah. That's a long, brutal set from hell is what that is.
The point that there's some various things that happen in the study, but one of the things is the group that did that did not grow as well as the group that did a more normal rest pause style set.
Mm.
Probably because they were doing too much.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's the thing too, that you have, and I'm tying this back into HIT training and what you obviously have figured out is this notion that you have a stimulus and you have an adaptation. And at some point your stimulus and adaptation are optimized. That could be two sets. That could be one set.
Yeah.
If you do three sets, you may have to rest 6 days. If you do two sets, you may have to rest 4 days.
Yeah.
One set may have to rest 2 days. But once you go past that, if you try to do six sets in a training session and try to come back at all to failure, because that's where you're getting effective reps, you're not going to recover from that 2 days later. You're not going to be recovered. So these guys were doing, those what their sets were like.
Yeah.
Up to 18 reps like that.
I need a lot of time off. Like, I need.
I mean, imagine someone who's just like totally, berserker.
Yeah.
Who is like doing 15 seconds in between those 18 reps. So they've got like, or even 20. So that'd be 360 seconds, something like that,
Yeah.
If they did that many. And so that's like 6 minutes of, that's like, those are 5 to 8 minute sets.
It's crazy.
I don't know. Like, I would love to see like more data, like documenting, like those sorts of things, because if you're going to take this information, it points you in the right direction, but like, what do these things really look like?
Yeah. Yeah.
Training, like what actually was going on. You describe them, and it's like, you kind of know the basics, but you don't really know, like there's that like the subjective effort level.
Mm-hmm.
Is a big piece of
okay it. That's a huge thing, because I kind of was thinking that too. Your version of three reps to failure, absolute failure, I think is going to be a lot different than, we'll say, like what my version was 5 years ago.
Eric Helms is the one who really kind of, it was his research that brought the reps and reserve notion into the literature, and in his studies, I've heard him talk about on his podcast, like one of the, they would ask people like, estimate your reps in reserve. Yeah. And they would be off like by 10 reps. So like, oh, I think I got two or three more left. And then when they actually push them to failure, they'd get 10 or 12 reps.
Huh. Wow.
I believe it. Way the hell off.
I believe it.
So then if you take that for those individuals who might have grown from what they perceived to be, a 12 rep max, when actually it was a 22 rep max.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe they have the last 12 reps are effective reps for them.
Yeah.
Because they got some growth.
Yeah.
Out of doing 12 reps with a 22 rep max. And like in the extreme case, or most people maybe off by like, I don't know what the numbers are. Let's say it's an average, or they're off by 5 reps.
Okay.
So they actually had 5 more in the tank than what they guessed. And they're still stopping, a couple reps shy of failure.
Yeah.
Or maybe they take what they do go to what they think is failure. They just stop there because they think, I got 2 or 3 more left. And they just stop because no one's telling them to keep going. And they just fail because that's what they've sort of predestined in their mind during the course of the set. But they actually got 5 more, but they still grow from that. So that means like the last 3 or 4 reps were maybe effective.
Yeah.
So the last 8 reps of a 15 rep max set might be effective reps for someone who's untrained initially.
Right.
So. Yeah, that's gigantic. Here's the thing that is interesting that I think is a major, it's a confounding factor, it seems to be at least, that we're sort of exploring here with the podcast, is that, and what Eric has talked about in the rep reserve thing, is that people in the research studies, just to sort of like have a quantifiable stimulus, they just say, we took the sets to failure.
Mm.
A lot of that's like we're not going to say like stop 3 reps shy of failure. They did X number of reps in reserve. In some studies, they've done that when that was part of what they're trying to examine, or like Cody Hahn. There's a study with Cody Hahn that looked at sarcoplasmic hypertrophy, and they employed a reps in reserve type of thing where they build up volume, et cetera, et cetera. Hmm. And so that was part of that study. Like, that's one I can think of off the top of my head. But normally it's like, no, but just do X number of work sets to failure. Standard warm-up protocol, and then you do all your sets were to failure. But that's like, so then you kind of like check that box in your method section. All the sets were to failure. But it really doesn't check the box.
Yeah, right.
Because if you're just saying like go to failure, like sometimes you can check that box by like, you know, measuring an exam, like the duration of a rep or rep speed.
Mm-hmm.
People have looked into that, you know, the velocity based training has become a thing. Mm-hmm. So obviously if you're really training all out, and you can see this, if you take muscle that is artificially activated, you know, you see it produces force, and the force just slowly declines.
Right.
So if someone's doing like continuous reps, you know, and they're going at a rep speed, eventually as fatigue ensues,
mm-hmm.
the reps slow down until they come to a grinding halt.
Right.
You wouldn't see like, which see with beginners, like, okay, I'm going. It's like, oh, this is getting hard. Woo, I'm done.
Yeah, right, right.
That was like the last rep looked like the first rep, you know? Yeah. So you can document that. But a lot of studies, they just said we took it to failure.
Right.
And like that can mean, according to what Eric has demonstrated, that can mean a difference in five reps, you know, depending on who you're talking about, as mm-hmm. far as whether it's truly to failure. Because that's all over the place. That's a huge difference in the actual stimulus that's evoked.
Right.
And it's just because of psychological reasons.
Hmm.
And that's why, you know, sometimes people who are like in the physics or some of the harder sciences,
mm-hmm.
where you can actually measure everything like, you know, very accurately and distinctly. They're like, you know, exercise science is so soft and weak because like it's all about like how, you know, you're how hard you're willing to push in your brain.
Hmm.
Failure is like just kind of dependent on the person, you know, what their pain tolerance is and all these psychological things.
Yeah.
You're not actually like you don't really have a distinctly quantifiable stimulus that's the same for all trainees.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's a matter of like, you know, like with animal research, at least, like, you know, you have all the rats that are pups from the same litter and they're basically genetically identical.
Right.
But you take humans in and you line up all those people, like all the guys in your research study, like all the college age guys.
Yeah.
Which a lot of these studies with college age guys, does that apply to 35-year-old guys whose testosterone levels are going down? Whole other topic.
Yeah.
But look at those guys and you're like, okay, so that guy won't make eye contact with anyone. He's really kind of anxious, you know.
Yeah.
He's here because he's, you know, probably he got sand kicked in his face. Like that's, you know, that's kind of part of his MO.
Yeah.
He wants to like build up his self-confidence. And you got another guy who's just like itching to get on there and like he wants to do like, give me some more. Can we do more sets? Like, no, don't get to train until you come in tomorrow or whenever. Like, stop.
Right.
Well, that's a whole, like, you've got to totally, it's like doing a research study and like, you know, so we just went out and gathered a random collection of wild animals. You know, so we had a raccoon and a bear and a rabbit and a deer, and we decided to do, you know, running training with them and yeah, like see like
see what kind of animal yeah see yeah see what the average is of how fast they, for some reason the raccoon runs a lot slower than the bear, you know.
Yeah. And like, yeah, but people would totally balk at that.
Yeah.
But you're not even the same species. Like, you can't really compare, you know, apples and oranges, bears and raccoons.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the psychology that you see, and we know this when you just look at how people train, like go in the regular gym.
Yes, exactly.
And you see the average person weight. Like, I see people who are reading their papers while they're doing knee extensions.
Yeah.
You know, and some people, like, they do knee extensions, they don't even know what muscle they're activating.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm training my whole, like, a hamstring. I'm like, no, that's just because your leg's pressing into the pad. It's not very well padded. That's why it hurts down there. You're not using your hamstrings for that, you know?
Yeah.
But they can't do. And then you got people like Jordan.
Yeah.
You know, who every time he trains, he does his effort levels beyond what most people would probably experience in their entire lifetime, at least in the Western world.
Hey, I got to throw in a guy named Juan, listener. I believe he said he is. Where's he coming from? He says, regards from Mexico. He said, we keep mentioning this guy named Jordan. And he said, who is this? Jordan Peters. I wanted to throw that out there for him who's watching.
Not Jordan Peterson, but Jordan Peters.
Jordan Peters. Very different guy. but also has some interesting philosophies.
Right. Yeah. Dream in his own right.
Yeah.
So, but that to failure training, it's you know, it makes sense to do that, but without some assurance in some way, shape, or form that there's something that is somehow equalized the training stimulus across subjects,
yeah,
across groups, really there's so much there that can contribute to the variability, I think.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, which I guess that you know what, that's part of it, I guess, when I say like, I'm not a big study guy. Like, cause I feel that way. Like I'd prefer to like listen to some like actual mm-hmm. in the trenches experience. Like to me, listening to Mensur like fires me up.
Right.
And then I guess that's part of it is like, there's all those little nuances, I guess, to really make, I mean, and I'm not saying you can't get anything out of training. I'm not saying I'm like anti-studies. I'm not saying I'm anti-studies, but it does leave, like there's so much, like, it sounds like you could make a study quite complex. You could take a lot of time to set that up, hand pick 20 people that were all going to have the same mindset on what failure was, for instance. That would mm-hmm. in itself would be tough to do.
Yeah, it is. It's just, I think the thing that a lot of times many people who are talking about science, like when people, the average person that, for instance, you would be exposed to who's talking about the scientific findings has probably just read the abstract.
Okay.
They may even have just a master's degree level, which should be pretty good.
Sure.
But it's not always. I know this from personal experience.
Okay.
That having a master's degree doesn't necessarily, even having a PhD in some cases doesn't mean that much, but you're not listening to people like Stu Phillips or Brad Schoenfeld. Mm. Brad, like, he knows the limitations.
Okay.
Of studies.
Yeah.
You know, and there are ways to delimit studies too. So we take people in who, you know, are not on HRT, and you know, they don't, we limit those people coming in because we know that those factors may, like, for instance, when I did my dissertation, we wouldn't let people in who were using albuterol.
Oh, okay.
I had a couple people I had to exclude because albuterol's kind of like clenbuterol, which clenbuterol is known, at least in animal work for sure, to induce muscle growth. It's potentially an anabolic agent.
Yeah.
So I had to exclude, I think, two people who had asthma.
Okay.
Because of that. So you have to exclude these sorts of things. So if you really look at the studies and you recognize what the limitations are and where you would be violating this idea of external validity, like do the untrained people who maybe are training with, you know, another 8 reps in the tank on average, does that really apply to someone who's been at it for 20 years?
Right.
No, not in many ways, no. But there are things that you can take from there. You just need to know how to weigh those in your mind. It doesn't, like, it's still the same universe.
Right.
You know, so like this, like this idea of different frequency of training being different, being better or worse for a given individual. So you saw that, like, huge variation in that study, like one leg trained 2 or 3 times a week, the other leg trained 5 times a week.
Yeah.
Some people did better with 5, some did with, well, that, there's no reason to think that doesn't apply to advanced people.
Right.
We know this, you know, we know this is the case. Jordan's gigantic, trains the way that he does. A lot of pros will train with the quote unquote bro split, you know, less, lower frequency, higher volume. So you see the same thing. You just need to, like, understand what the limitations are and not take it too far.
Yeah.
And that takes an under. There's just so much to it. But it only takes a little bit of digging, really. There was a study that Victor Black posted about this on Facebook.
Okay.
And he was on a podcast, or he and I were on a podcast, Joe Jeffrey's podcast,
yeah,
with Austin Stout. And he posted about, you know, the sort of the thing that he, like, you got so many of these scientists who are like, that's their wheelhouse and that's their perspective, and they haven't been in the trenches. And he posted in talking about this idea, he posted just a screen capture from Instagram where someone was talking about, God, what was it? It wasn't arginine. It was a supplement that increased growth hormone levels.
Mm-hmm.
And it did, you know. It when you ran the stats, taking this supplement in these conditions in the morning had an impact on growth hormone levels. But so I'm like, okay. So I actually found the study, read the study, and then I went and looked at what variations in growth, knowing that growth hormone is pulsatile in nature, and how high it can get at night.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the increases in growth hormone after this supplement was given were like, you know, a third, a quarter of what max values would be at during sleep. So if you want to get a better growth hormone level, just take a nap.
Yeah.
You're going to get higher on average, you get higher peaks.
Yeah.
And all that just took me some time. I just went and I looked at the numbers. I had to convert the units.
Mm-hmm.
The units were in like nanomoles per milliliter, and I had to convert it to IUs per liter or whatever, to more typical unit. But I just compared the math. It's like, well, that's not really relevant. Like, yeah, it happened.
Yeah.
You could throw it in your face. It increased growth hormone significantly. It's like, okay, so, you know, it's like, you get free gas when you go to the Wawa station. It's like, okay, like they give you like 2 ounces of gas. It's free gas, right?
Yeah.
And everyone who went to Wawa had higher gas than the people who went to the Circle K.
Yeah.
Well, it's 2 ounces of gas. Like that'll get you down the block.
Yeah.
It's insignificant in a practical reward setting. So you dig in, you look at the research, like, what can I take from that? Well, yeah, maybe if I go to Wawa every day,
mm-hmm.
and get my gas there, and I take 2 ounces times 365,
yeah,
that makes a difference. I'll take a couple free tanks of gas over the course of the year,
yeah.
and do that. But I'm not expecting that to like increase, you know, the distance I can travel with my car. Like all of a sudden now I can start taking road trips, you know, to Canada and back or
right,
whatever,
right.
in your case. So you just have to spend some time digging in.
Mm-hmm.
So the scientists spend time digging in, understanding what the limitations are of their studies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's like their version of the guy who's like going in the gym and tinkering around with the things that you've talked about doing.
Yeah.
And they're just two sides of the same coin.
I like that. I like to know that. I guess you know what bothers me, and it is off. We're way off tangent now. It's the guys that just like cite something. You know, it's like to prove a point that's often to tell us that we've been wrong about everything we know. that's the stuff that
right.
I think
and
is.
That's,
I
and
think
that's
of.
Painting a black and white picture, and yeah. it's really not black. Like you wouldn't tell. You know, Nathan DeAsha, who I think trains with pretty high volume, like he's got a great chest. Like, dude, you're doing too much volume.
Right, right. No, I better not tell him anything.
Ronnie, you should have trained like Dorian. Dorian, you should have trained like Ronnie. Like,
yeah.
No. And the science actually supports that idea that there's different frequencies and volumes for different people. If you look at deeply at the science.
Yeah.
So the two things don't contradict one another really. And the people that will come out with a black and white, in many cases, they haven't dug in enough. They're like the person who's gone to the gym. They've been training for like maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years. I'm kind of stereotyping, and all of a sudden they figure out. And I've even had people do this with fortitude training. They're like, oh, fortitude training. That's the only training system I'll ever use again. It's awesome. It's like it's the greatest thing. And I'm like, I wouldn't do that. Like you know, don't write your name in blood to always doing fortitude training. It works well for you. That's great, but. So someone reads a study and, you know, says, well, this is the way the numbers are black and white. It's like, well, pay attention. How does that see the forest from the trees here? How does it all fit together?
Yeah.
You know, and that's really, and a lot of times people just haven't dug in enough. There's still the people who are doing that. You won't see a really good scientist do that.
Hmm.
In
yeah.
my opinion, they will always, that's why they speak in circles. Like that's why I have these long convoluted sentences. Sometimes because context is so much.
Right, right, yeah.
And you can't really convey the idea in a simple way, simple terms, because they're not simple ideas.
Yeah, I live my life talking to somebody that speaks that way.
Yeah, you do, of course. There's very good reasons for it. Yeah, and you love her to death.
Yeah,
right?
She wants to make sure all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed if she's going to say something, you know.
Right. Yeah, but the information density is important. You know?
Yeah. Well, my head's spinning here, Scott. I'm spinning with thoughts of Mike Mentzer and HIIT training.
You want to go to grad school now, don't you? You want to get your PhD, I can tell.
I want to go to the gym, actually. I want to go. And today's a non-training day, so I'm not. But how about, are you training today?
Yeah. Today's an upper body day. Ooh. Muscle round style.
We're like an hour and 15 minutes in here. How do you want to try to answer any of our questions, or you want to maybe take them on the next one? What do you think?
Do we have any pop up?
We had some pop up on the feed. Yes.
Ooh, let me see what we get. That sounds fun.
All right, here we go. Let's see what we got here. We had a question about prostate health. I'll pull this one up on the screen here. Hey guys, love the content. Prostate health. I have an enlarged prostate. PSA is climbing. Have had a checkup. I did try Rad 140. that I think it means Dante suggested a year ago. Is it Dante? I don't know. Danta suggested a year ago. I don't remember him suggesting Rad 140. Dropped a whole point, now climbing again. Any thoughts or advice on supplements that really work, like saw, palmetto, and doses? This is from Jerry. Ooh.
Yeah, so I would let's see. I'm trying to decipher Danta. So Dante, someone suggested using a SARM.
Yeah,
the lower prostate.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I prostate health. That's a pretty important one. My dad, prostate cancer is probably what got him.
Okay.
So prostate, health is near and dear to my heart, so to speak. I would check with the doc, and check in on that. I wouldn't try to, if it's climbing and it's still climbing, especially, I would go see a physician, and see what's going on there. That could be his, like, what's your family history of cancer? That's the type that he's asking for, like, cancer cures.
Okay.
Potentially,
Yeah.
I mean, I'm blowing this out of proportion, but yeah, just watch the PSA thing. That's not one to mess around with.
All right. Yeah. And then we had another one here from Ryan. He says, does Dr. Scott have any feedback to justify the cost of, what's this, magnesium L-threonate?
Threonate.
Versus others?
You have to look at I don't know what he'd be paying for one versus the other.
Okay.
And why he's using the magnesium. So,
okay.
What doses he feels like he needs or what effect he's looking for. If you're just looking for, to maintain magnesium levels, you might get plenty from your multivitamin.
Okay.
If he's looking to use it to like help with sleep, for instance.
Yeah.
It's a cofactor for a shitload of enzymes, actually. Magnesium is a cofactor. It's really kind of an under-recognized mineral in that sense, but it's like the mag zinc combination is in lots of sleep formulas.
Yeah.
Because magnesium, the idea is magnesium is a cofactor for catechol-O-methyltransferase, which is the enzyme in the brain that breaks down dopamine, which is one of the catechol.
Oh, yeah. I knew it sounded familiar. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. COMT.
Yes.
So
yeah.
So people actually, we were talking about placebo. That's one of the, main, there's a couple studies at least have found that your genotype for COMT, which is going to dictate how fast you break down dopamine and therefore how the levels of dopamine that you maintain in your brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is predictive of your amenability to a placebo effect.
Huh.
So okay. People's perceptions of situations change, depend on the level of excitability that they have.
That makes total sense.
Yeah, yeah, like some memories you have, like when like people can remember like details of accidents and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Either like they completely dissociate, because they're like in shock and they're stressed out.
Yeah.
Or they like have like this absolutely vivid memory of these like really exciting situations.
Yeah.
Or something that was at least arousing in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So it seems like that people who have the slower isoform of COMT tend to have higher likelihood of having a placebo have an effect.
Hmm, okay.
Because they're given something and they're more excitable and you have like, you get something like you're getting something like, what is this? I don't know what's going to do.
Yeah.
Ooh, so they get excited and then that will change their perception of what they're getting in a way that would tend to make them think they're going to have it. So magnesium is involved with COMT. If you want CMT to be able to be fully function to break down dopamine levels when you're trying to sleep.
Okay.
You don't want to be riled up and excited.
Okay.
So that would be the reason why. So if he's, I don't know what I haven't honestly, because he's just, I don't know if the 3 and 8 is helping with absorption and, or maybe making it time released in a way, but if he's using it for sleep, he could just compare, like break it down to what happens for him.
There you go.
One versus the other,
yeah.
Because sleep is so complex.
Yeah.
There's so many things, adenosine levels and neurotransmitter levels. You can, attack it with 5-HTP and deal with serotonin. Then there's magnesium, which is kind of dealing with dopamine. Like caffeine is not your friend
right.
when it comes to sleeping because of the adenosine receptor. that's why a lot of good sleep formulas have like a time release melatonin too, that can help. So you have to know like why he's using this. And if he's talking about like literally, you can find powdered stuff really cheap. Like Amazon has a bunch. Okay. Oh, Trendsomnia.
Yeah.
Just said. Yeah. So you'd have to try the other version and report back. Okay. There you go. That's a good, that's what I would say, Ryan. Yeah. To see, because it could be your Trendsomnia. Obviously trend is what you think is causing it, but it could be, you know, that the trend is just sort of exacerbating whatever tendencies for insomnia you may already have.
Hmm.
And it may be because of, maybe because of the dopamine, which is what, you know,
yeah.
There's a good, he probably heard this, Dr. Dean St. Mark did a FUEDS podcast.
Yeah. You know what too? I have, we did that before. And I was just about to say, I recorded with Dr. Dean a few times. We talked about that twice. One of them was on the old network, on the Advices Radio YouTube page. For anybody who's listening to this, we have the, and you didn't know, we have the Think Big Bodybuilding Media. So we did a 30-minute segment about this. I'll have to release that because I haven't released it yet. But I was going to say Dr. Dean has a supplement that is fan
supplement
needs. I'll put a link, and we have a code actually, Advices now. We have an affiliate code with them. You can get a 10% discount. It's actually Advices 10, I think. I'll put the code in our description for this show. But I'll tell you what. So that product works amazing, Scott. Like I have never used a sleep supplement that works like that does. And it helps you to clear the dopamine so that you can get better quality rest. I mean, that's just one of the mechanisms. But that's where I first learned about what COMT was listening to Dr. Dean. Having a conversation with him.
Well, let me Google it here. Can you get this? It's a UK based company. Can you get it in?
You can, US, and he has Amazon? Like a flat rate. No, not through Amazon. You have to go through, I believe it's supplementneeds.com. I believe that's the only way. And he set up like a flat rate shipping now. So you can order, you know, several Procket products if you wanted to try to, you know, maximize. But that's a great one. They're the sleep product. And I'm a big fan of their liver product too. Their liver health product is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It has 800 milligrams of Tutka in it. If you take the ooh, full serving,
okay.
I mean, it's like a powerhouse. There's nothing else like that on the market. And we've had this code set up.
He's got vitamin B6, P5P, which is pyridoxal 5-phosphate, which is vitamin B6, I believe.
Yeah.
He's got zinc methionine in his.
Okay.
So that may not, you know. Ryan, if you get a hold of some of the, like, I've heard that about all of Dr. Dean's stuff.
Yeah. It's
good stuff.
It's honestly, like I said, man, I wake up feeling like happy, if that makes sense. Like I wake up and it's like, there's a bluebird chirping on my shoulder and the sun has a smile on its face, yeah, and, you know,
right. Whistle while we work, you know.
Yeah, all of that. Let's see.
Usually you're a grouch in the morning, Scott. I wake up and try to get a little frisky with you, and you're just like, no, leave me alone. Don't touch me. I just like so many of the don't touch me days.
I need my coffee, you know.
I know, exactly. Let me get you some coffee, maybe I can get in and wake up.
What's this here from Travis James? He asks, let's see. Hey, guys. Love to hear your views. Woo. He and I just talked about this on DM. High hematocrit, while platelets are within range, low end of normal, would donating blood be a good option at this point? I've heard it's only really a concern if platelets are high with RBCs.
Well, just if you're looking kind of strictly at clotting potential.
Mm-hmm.
In a certain way, yes, but you're also increasing the viscosity of the blood.
Yeah.
So your heart's going to have to pump a little bit harder there. And if that does in any way, you know, slow the speed at which the blood is moving, you know, blood that's sort of stagnating or pooling is not good in terms of clot risk. That's
okay.
Why a lot of times people, like the common, I don't know if this happened or not, but, you know, John and I wondered if maybe, because he spends a lot of time with his computer, John Meadows, who had a heart attack recently, if maybe he had a deep vein thrombosis, so a venous thrombus that dislodged, so So he had one like in his lower leg, which is where people typically get them, and then became an embolus that made it to his heart, and he had a myocardial infarction. So yeah, you just like, that's just a really high hematocrit. That in of itself, I believe, is a risk factor for having
like a stroke coronary,
a cardiovascular or cerebrovascular event. So yeah, I wouldn't just say, well, my platelets are good. Because John doesn't quite know, I don't think, why this happened to him in particular, but he had, you know, his coronary, this isn't everything, but he had a calcium score that was like, you know, top notch.
Right.
And everything else seemed to be good. And I think if you ask, like, for instance, if you were asked John, if he had a hematocrit right now of 59, what would he do about it? He'd probably try to end that, you know, bloodlet that, or figure out why. I mean, I presume this is probably, I'm guessing this is an anabolic, not insinuating anything, Travis, but if this is anabolics related, then, you know, you probably want to address that.
Having spoke to him on DM, I'll just say it's safe to, you're safe in assuming.
Yeah, that's just really high. There's been the thing that people, and I presume this is from EPO use and sometimes, blood doping, using their own blood. Yeah. Cyclists have done this.
Yeah.
So there's a trade-off. One of the things that seems to limit cycling performance is red blood cell count. So some of that is probably not only the ability to deliver more oxygen. If you look, I won't get into all this, but if you look at if you can make measurements of maximal blood flow in skeletal muscle.
Yeah.
And when you compare that to what you can get in during whole body exercise, or like cycling is not quite whole body, but it's pretty close, you know, a lot of muscle mass involved. You can only get about one third of the blood flow because the heart is the limiter in terms of providing blood and oxygen.
Wow.
There's a central limitation to blood flow distribution of skeletal muscle. So like you do like a one legged leg extension, your heart can deliver plenty of blood and you can get plenty of vasodilation in the arteries and arterioles to make that happen. But you start doing whole body stuff and then you've got a limitation. Your heart can't pump as much, but you can deliver more oxygen if you have a higher red blood cell count. But there's a trade-off. Like the higher that gets, the more viscous the blood is, and then that also taxes the heart. So you would have to kind of optimize those things for performance.
Yeah.
And cyclists, like triathletes, are pretty. Cyclists do all sorts of crazy shit. Like, you know, the Lance Armstrong thing people kind of know, but triathletes are extreme athletes. They do all sorts of crazy stuff. Bodybuilders, of course, too, but cyclists do all that sort of thing. So there's been a number of cases of cyclists who've died from heart attacks. When they've looked at their hematocrit, it was like up in the 60s, which is really high, like 65. But 59 is pretty high. You're getting up there, and these people would have heart attacks while they're exercising. And your risk, in general, your risk of having a heart attack goes up when you exercise.
Mm.
If you're trained and you're healthy, like the more active you are, generally speaking, that just lowers your overall risk of a heart attack.
Mm.
So like if you looked at like the relative risk, let's say one is the average person, and you look at your relative risk of having a heart attack over a 24-hour day and you exercise for an hour, like your relative risk might, for that 1 hour, might be 3.
Okay.
Or something like that. I don't know the exact numbers, but I can't recall them at least. But during the rest of the day, when you're not exercising, it's for the other 23 hours, it's 0.5.
Yeah. Okay.
So you average that out and it's like 0.55 is your average relative risk because of your level of training.
Right.
Your level of activity. So probably just thinking about cardiodynamics, if you've now increased your the viscosity of your blood with that hematocrit, thinking about these cyclists too, you've got a relative risk of having a heart attack while you're exercising that's elevated just without any elevation in red blood cell count and hematocrit. And now you've just sort of amplified that because you've got this increased viscosity, even if your platelets are in place. I don't think John had any platelet issues, for instance, not to keep invoking John, but you can sort of think, like, what would John do? It's a good thing. And John's a very health conscious guy. He had everything lined up and still shit happens.
Yeah.
So I would like think of it maybe from that perspective and say, yeah, probably should take care of that and get that back down. You never know.
I'll tell you what, after having done it for the first time in my life, I felt a lot better after, like, immediately. First day after, my pumps were terrible. But okay. 2-3 days after that, I was back to normal. And I'll tell you what, man, I just felt so much less like pressure, you know, pressure in my head. And I was more prone to headaches before that. And mine was only a couple points above normal. I was like, can't remember what it was now, but it was like 51 maybe or something. It was like two or three points above range. But I could see, I could feel a physical difference just overall. So, I mean, I'd highly suggest it if he's that high, you know.
Yeah. The red blood cells, I mean, they're also involved with hemoglobin as a buffer in the blood too.
Okay.
So they're involved with, there's the carbonic anhydrase enzyme is contained in the red blood cells, and that's involved with the bicarbonate buffering system. Okay. So you have better ability to buffer lactic acidosis brought on by exercise.
Oh.
So there's a performance effect from that.
Okay.
So that's why, like, there are bodybuilders who use this EPO.
Okay. Is that why EQ is known as being to help your stamina?
Yeah. Yeah. That's why they give it to horses.
Okay.
So it's a horse steroid, yeah, but they give it like horse, like I mentioned this, I think all the podcasts were together.
So yeah. I remember you saying this. Podcast. Yeah. You mentioned this on drugs and stuff, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. That was the one, right? It'll keep me straight, man. The Alzheimer's is kicking up really fast, early onset dementia. But yeah, like the horse performance people just go bonkers with all this stuff, and they give, like, they inject buffers, and, you know, they give things to increase like B6, I think, or B12, you know, all sorts of stuff to try to promote hemopoiesis or hematopoiesis or erythropoiesis. Hmm. So yeah, buffering is really important for performance. So that's, you know, you'll notice, you might lose a little loss of stamina, loss of pump, that kind of thing, but you know, you want to live to train another day as well. So there's a trade-off.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I'll go back to Juan's question he asked earlier when he was asking about Jordan, because he also did ask. He said, "Are there any other names besides guys like Dante Trudell and Mike Mensur that you would throw in there with people who do this type of high intensity training we were talking about that we could look to learn from?"
I mean, Arthur Jones stuff is kind of worth reading. I mean, it's somewhat commercialized. Like, he's kind of like the one of the early guys. God, I'm trying to think who's sort of on that end.
Your Titan guy. Would he be?
Leo Costa. Yeah, I'm not sure what has happened to him, to be honest.
Okay.
But yeah, his stuff, a lot of it was pretty high volume.
Oh, okay.
Too, like, yeah, so he had, like, his big program was Big Beyond Belief.
Okay. I only know about it through you, from you talking about it.
Yeah, yeah. And so I looked, I was looking to just, like, try to develop, you know, come up with some new things.
Yeah.
And just trying to still learn, you know, experiment. So I looked, the Big Beyond Belief has kind of like a cult following. People would do that. And that's like there's another version of that, I think. Maybe he came out with two versions of the system, but the Big Beyond Belief is a pretty high volume.
Okay.
6 day a week type training program. And I've looked at that, and I'm like, there's just no way, you know, I'm just not going to be able to do that. I would have to like not train to failure in order to do that number, that many sets.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in that case, then that's not our guy then. So,
but there's, you know, like one of the things that he, like, yeah, he has, there's some things to learn from everyone, you know, dig into it. I'm trying to think, cause, any other big names that do this sort of stuff that people would want to look into. There's just so much with Dante, intense muscle, you know, just go and dig through that.
Yeah.
Dorian.
Yeah. There. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, digging on Dorian. He's like the primary example, I guess. That Marcus Reinhardt guy has got some videos out. I don't know if he just sort of vanished from the scene. There are people that do this sort of thing who just train their clients that way. Mm. I've, you know, come across trainers over the years. There is a guy, Ellington Darden. You want to look into him? Ellington Darden, you can look into his stuff. I think he's kind of an HIT sort of guy.
Okay.
And there's another guy whose name I'm blanking on. Who's an HIT guy who has done some videos, and there's some seminars you can find.
Okay.
So
I get some good insights, some good resources.
Yeah, yeah. There's tons of stuff. You just keep digging, man. There's so many rabbit holes. Just keep it all in, you know, in context.
All right. Well, that's all we got, Scott. That's a good. I think we put out a lot.
Was Trevor Smith? Yeah. Juan mentioned Trevor Smith.
Oh.
Yeah. God. Yes. Trevor Smith. See. He did a thing with Matt. What was Matt's name? It was an IFBB pro who's now passed on. So was it? What was Trevor Smith's training plan called? I'm gonna look it up now. I need to know this. Smith. Yeah.
But did he pass away, Trevor Smith?
Yeah, he's dead too.
See, with nuclear.
Nuclear Nutrition was the name of his company. Yeah, he had a great demon training, is what he called it.
Huh.
And his stuff was. There's some videos out here I haven't seen. I might have to check this out. But his stuff was, Beyond Failure Training. Okay, that's what that's his training system.
Okay.
And his, Matt Duvall.
Matt Duvall. Wow.
Yeah, that's who he did that with.
I think Matt Duvall was out of Michigan.
I think he could have. I lived in North Carolina, I think, for a while. But
I think he was originally.
Yeah. Yeah, Trevor was over 400 pounds.
Whew.
I saw him at the Olympia, or the USA's, I think, once. He's just giant, just a huge guy.
Yeah.
He passed on. I think he had a heart attack in his kitchen, something like that. At
33.
2005. Oh, shit. Wow. Yeah, he's big, man. But, yeah, his stuff, and I remember reading about that. His stuff was like, you know, quintuple drop sets.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, crazy, just absolutely decimate the muscle,
hmm.
which probably for a lot of guys, unless you're like your life is bodybuilding 24/7.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't be able to recover from that, I'm thinking. But yeah, he was really, that was probably even too much.
Wow.
See, that's the thing is like, get the most from the least. If you're training in a certain way, like you have had a very sort of, a slow, logical transition from what you were once doing to what you're currently doing.
Right.
You know, and you did some good experiments like with your back training, that kind of stuff, but you didn't like go from like, you know, trying to do 15 to 20 sets for a muscle group, leaving several reps in the tank every time to all of a sudden I'm going to do one all out, you know, 8-stage drop set every 3 weeks.
No.
You know,
like, it was a natural progression.
Like, So think about like, what can you take from that idea? Like, what maybe am I lacking? You know, would I be better off doing like 8 really high quality sets as hard as I possibly can, as opposed to like, you know, fluffing around? Am I sandbagging when I'm trying to do 20 sets? Are those really good?
Yeah.
Or is a lot of that just junk volume, you know? So, but yeah, the Beyond Failure Training, from what I recall, that was like kind of like cybergenics style shit.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and you know, I've talked, the cybergenics was just, you know, quintuple drop sets, positive and negative failure.
I'm looking at Trevor Smith now, and I'm shocked at how big he was. You said he got to 400 pounds. Now, granted, Dave Palumbo was in contest shape, but I'm looking at a picture of him next to Dave Palumbo, making Dave look like a middleweight bodybuilder or something.
Yeah, here's a picture of him next to Ronnie.
I've got that one too.
Biggest, yeah.
I'll put that one up too. He looks like bigger than Ronnie, basically.
Well, yeah, a little bit taller, but you know, and doesn't have Ronnie's structure.
Right, they're both in shirts, so there's that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, he was a big dude, man. Beyond Failure Training, that's what it was. Like, here's one of him next. Oh my God, there's one next to Dorian. It may have been like after Dorian had retired.
Okay.
And he looks like he's a little downsized, but Trevor's like faxed out, and Dorian looks like his little brother.
I got one up next to Jay, and he's like, you know, he looks like Jay's taller brother, you know.
Yeah, and look how big his arm, like Jay's arm is. Both arms are crazy, but
yeah,
he had to have like 23 inch arms.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
It looks like a crazy wear shirt, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, he wore all the stuff.
Yep. That's a trip.
Yeah, and there was one with his wife. I remember like after like he passed, and like his wife like tried to like take care of his business and stuff, and
yeah,
you know, I think she sold off some of the like a lot of supplements they had. But
okay.
Yeah, so his training was, there's some like sort of blog type post stories of like what the training, like someone kind of taking you through the training.
Okay.
You know, and all the anxiety that leads up to it. Everything, like when you know what you're going to do, it's like, this is, every workout's going to be like one of the most diabolically difficult things that you've ever experienced. And that's the idea.
Yeah.
It's like, you're going to, like, it's going to be a, like a death defying level of pain.
Yeah.
You know, and suffering. And it's not going to be over and done. It's not like you got a couple reps, you know, that are really tough and then it sets over.
Yeah.
You're fucking, you know, you're dying, you know? So, but you know, I do those. I was in a drop set kick there for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I posted some of those up on Instagram, and I was doing like, I would do like, I just did this the other week cause I was kind of in a hurry, and I did like a rack dead, I think with six plates.
Okay.
And then I did a bent over row with four plates. And then I went to 405 and then 365 and 315 and 275 and 2 1/4
of
bent over rows. So it was like, what is that? Like six,
yeah,
something like that. I like those. Those are fun.
My lower back would be screaming at me, but I could imagine what you got out of that.
Oh, there! I wish I could train that way all the time. I would. I just can't get away with it. It doesn't help me progress, and I get so sore afterwards. I just can't do. But I could only do like one of those. Like I might do like a pull down, like rest pause set. Now I've gone back to regular formal fortitude training, but this is when I was doing a lot of traveling and things were kind of messed up with the pandemic, et cetera. So,
yeah.
But I was down south at the gym I train in. Smash Fitness is in Bonita Springs. It's called Smash.
I like that.
Yeah. Good, really good gym actually. And I like training down there. So I'm just like, I'm going to have some, I did a rack through the rack pull and then just whatever that is. And it's, I love training that way. And it's, like the thing is, there's something to say for like taking some of these things and doing them now and again,
mm-hmm.
not in excess. You still want to be able to recover. And then when you go back to regular training, it seems relatively so easy. And you recognize, I've just got this one set.
Yeah.
What can I put into this one set? Because there's no drop set. There's no like, I'm not thinking, okay, I gotta survive the 405 and the 365 and the 315 and the 275 and the 2 1/4.
Right.
So you leave a little bit maybe because you know you're gonna like the whole set is gonna be so diabolical. If you're at 95%, you're still gonna get a lot out of it. It may be too much anyway.
Yeah.
And then when you go back to just doing a straight set, you're like, I'm done in 10 seconds. I'm gonna just destroy this shit.
Yeah.
And you get that from doing like stuff like a Beyond Failure type of training or like some of like a John Meadows challenge set. Everything becomes relatively less difficult in psychologically speaking. So then you recognize to what extent you have been maybe sandbagging a little bit, even if it's not, you're not clearly saying, like noticing in your mind that like, oh, I'm kind of broken, I'm stopping this set. And you're like, fuck, I should have got another one. Like
you're
not kicking yourself because you know you gave up,
right?
But you recognize that there's something that you might not have been doing that you could have been doing.
Hmm.
And that comes from trying some of these things where it's really, really hard. So I'm big on the experimentation, and see, who knows? Beyond Failure training is friggin' ridiculous. No one's doing it.
Yeah.
That I know of. I don't like, it's not like a going training style, but some people just won't do DC training either because they don't want to train that way. It's not fun for them anymore.
Yeah.
You can't like talk to people in between and you have to like, yeah, you have to be like really totally single-minded
and uncomfortable going into some serious discomfort in some of those sets.
Yeah, you have to thrive on that,
Yeah,
so.
All right, well, let's get out of here, guys. Thanks for everybody tuning in here at the live feed. Guys, if you haven't subscribed yet at the YouTube page, why don't you? Why don't you do it? We have several podcasts coming out each week. And of course, speaking of training programs, check out fortitudetraining.net for Scott's ebook. It's only like $20, so pick it up, check it out. Great program. And of course, byobbcoach.com. That's where you can pick up Scott's ebook for the Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book. We'll also have the Amazon affiliate link if you want to check out the hardcover. And of course, go to our sponsors, truenutrition.com and getazoth.com. Dr. Scott, I hope you have a great workout today.
Thanks, brother. Yeah, enjoy your off day. See you guys. Thanks for the questions. The questions were great. Appreciate it.